Its claws sought Eddie, who ducked, screaming. They razored through the back of his shirt, cutting it open, drawing shallow scarlet lines along his shoulder blades. Eddie yelled and tried to crawl away, but the bird wheeled back again. Mike broke forward, digging in his pocket. He came out with a one-blade buck knife. As the bird dived on Eddie again, he swept it in a quick, tight arc across one of the bird's talons. It cut deep and blood poured out. The bird banked away and then came back, folding its wings, diving in like a bullet. Mike fell to one side at the last moment, slashing upward with the buck knife. He missed, and the bird's claw hit his wrist with such force that his hand went numb and tingly. The bruise that later bloomed there went most of the way to his elbow. The buck flew into the dark. The bird came back, screeching triumphantly, and Mike rolled his body over Eddie's and waited for the worst. Stan walked forward toward the two boys huddled on the floor as the bird returned. He stood, small and somehow trim in spite of the dirt grimed into his hands and arms and pants and shirt, and suddenly held his hands out in a curious gesture, palms up, fingers down. The bird uttered another squawk and sheered off, bulleting by Stan, missing him by inches, lifting his hair and then dropping it in the buffeting wake of its passage. He turned in a tight circle to face its return. "I believe in scarlet tanagers, even though I never saw one," he said in a high, clear voice. The bird screamed and banked away as if he'd shot at it. "Same with vultures and the New Guinea mudlark and the flamingos of Brazil." The bird screamed, circled, and suddenly flew on up the tunnel, squawking. "I believe in the golden bald eagle," Stan screamed after it, "and I think there really might be a phoenix somewhere. But I don't believe in you, so get the fuck out of here. Get out. Hit the road, Jack." He stopped then, and the silence seemed very large. Bill, Ben, and Beverly went to Mike and Eddie. They helped Eddie to his feet, and Bill looked at the cuts. "Not the deep," he said, "but I bet they hurt like hell." "It tore my shirt to pieces, Big Bill." Eddie's cheeks glistened with tears, and he was wheezing again. The bellowing barbarian's voice was gone. It was hard to believe it had ever been there. "What am I going to tell my mom?" Bill smiled a little. "Why don't we worry about that when we get out of here? Give yourself a blahasta, Eddie." Eddie did, inhaling deeply and then wheezing. "That was great, man," Richie told Stan. "That was just frockin' great." Stan was shivering all over. "There's no bird like that, that's all. There never has been, and there never will be." "We're coming!" Henry screamed from behind them. His voice was utterly demented. He was laughing and howling now. He sounded like something that has crawled out of a crack in the roof of hell. "Me and Belch, we're coming, and we'll get you little punks. You can't get away." Bill shouted, "Get out, Henry, while there's still time." Henry's response was a hollow, inarticulate scream. They heard a hustle of footsteps, and in a burst of comprehension, Bill understood Henry's whole purpose. He was real. He was mortal. He could not be stopped by an aspirator or a bird book. Magic would not work on Henry. He was too stupid. "Come on. We gotta stay ahead of him." They went on again, holding hands, Eddie's tattered shirt flapping behind him. The light grew brighter, the tunnel ever huger. As it canted downward, the ceiling flew away above until they could barely see it. It now seemed to them that they were not walking in a tunnel at all, but making their way through a titanic underground courtyard, the approach to some cyclopean castle. The light from the walls had become a running green-yellow fire. The smell was stronger, and they began to pick up a vibration that might have been real or might have been only in their minds. It was steady and rhythmic. It was a heartbeat. "It ends up ahead," Beverly cried. "Look, it's a blank wall." But as they drew closer, amp-like now on this great floor of dirty stone blocks, each block bigger than Basie Park, it seemed, they saw that the wall was not entirely blank after all. It was broken by a single door. And although the wall itself towered hundreds of feet above them, the door was very small. It was no more than 3 feet high, a door of the sort you might see in a fairy tale book, made of stout oaken boards bound with iron strips in an X pattern. It was they all realized at once. A door made only for children. Ghostly, in his mind, Ben heard the librarian reading to the little ones, "Who is that trip-trapping upon my bridge?" The children leaned forward, all the old fascination glistening in their eyes. Will the monster be bested, or will it feed? There was a mark on the door, and heaped at its foot was a pile of bones. Small bones. The bones of God alone knew how many children. They had come to the place of it. The mark on the door, then. What was that? Bill marked it as a paper boat. Stan saw it as a bird rising toward the sky. A phoenix, perhaps. Michael saw a hooded face. The crazy Butch Bowers, perhaps, if it could only be seen. Richie saw two eyes behind a pair of spectacles. Beverly saw a hand doubled up into a fist. Eddie believed it to be the face of the leper, all sunken eyes and wrinkled, snarling mouth. All disease, all sickness was stamped into that face. Ben Hanscom saw a tattered pile of wrappings and seemed to smell old, sour spices. Later, arriving at that same door with Belch's screams still echoing in his ears, alone at the end of it, Henry Bowers would see it as the moon, full, ripe, and black. "I'm scared, Bill," Ben said in a wavering voice. "Do we have to?" Bill towed the bones and suddenly scattered them in a powdery, rattling drift with one foot. He was scared, too. But there was George to consider. It had ripped off George's arm. Were those small and fragile bones among these? Yes, of course they were. They were here for the owners of the bones, George and all the others, those who had been brought here, those who might be brought here, those who had been left in other places simply to rot. "We have to," Bill said. "What if it's locked?" Beverly asked in a small voice. "It's not locked," Bill said, and then told her what he knew from deeper inside. "Places like this are never locked." He placed the tented fingers of his right hand on the door and pushed. It swung open on a flood of sick yellow-green light. That zoo smell wafted out at them, incredibly strong, incredibly potent now. One by one, they passed through the fairy tale door and into the lair of it. Bill, 7, in the tunnels, 4:59 a.m. Stopped so suddenly that the others piled up like freight cars when the engine suddenly comes to a panic stop. "What is it?" Ben called. It was here. Do you remember? "I remember," Richie said. "Eddie stopped it with his aspirator by pretending it was acid. He said something about some dance. Pretty chuckalicious, but I can't remember exactly what it was." It doesn't matter. We won't see anything we saw before, Bill said. He struck a light and looked around at the others. Their faces were luminous in the glow of the match, luminous and mystic, and they seemed very young. "How you guys doing?" "We're okay, Big Bill," Eddie said, but his face was drawn with pain. Bill's makeshift splint was coming apart. "How about you?" "Oh, okay," Bill said, and shook out the match before his face could tell them any different story. "How did it happen?" Beverly asked him, touching his arm in the dark. "Bill, how could she?" Because I mentioned the name of the town, Shishika came after me. Even when I was doing it, something inside was telling me to shut up. But I didn't listen. He shook his head helplessly in the dark. "But even if she came to Derry, I don't understand how she could have gotten down here. If Henry didn't bring her, then who did?" "It," Ben said. "It doesn't have to look bad, we know that. It could have shown up and said you were in trouble, taken her here in order to... to fuck you up, I suppose. To kill our guts. Because that's what you always were, Big Bill. Our guts." "Tom?" Beverly said in a low, almost musing voice. "Who?" Bill struck another match. She was looking at him with a kind of desperate honesty.
Tom, my husband, he knew too. At least I think I mentioned the name of the town to him, the way you mentioned it to Audra. I don't know if it took or not. He was pretty angry with me at the time.
Jesus, what is this, some kind of soap opera where everybody turns up sooner or later? Richie said.
Not a soap opera, Bill said, sounding sick. A show, like the circus.
Bev here went and married Henry Bowers. When she left, why wouldn't he come here? After all, the real Henry did.
No, Beverly said. I didn't marry Henry. I married my father.
If he beat on you, what's the difference? Eddie asked.
Come around me, Bill said. Move in.
They did. Bill reached out to either side and found Eddie's good hand in one of Richie's hands. Soon they stood in a circle, as they had done once before when the number was greater. Eddie felt someone put an arm around his shoulders. The feeling was warm and comforting and deeply familiar. Bill felt the sense of power that he remembered from before, but understood with some desperation that things really had changed. The power was nowhere near as strong. It struggled and flickered like a candle flame in foul air. The darkness seemed thicker and closer to them, more triumphant. And he could smell it.
Down this passageway, he thought, and not so terribly far, is a door with a mark on it. What was behind that door? It's the one thing I still can't remember. I can remember making my fingers stiff because they wanted to tremble, and I can remember pushing the door open. I can even remember the flood of light that streamed out and how it seemed almost alive, as if it wasn't just light but fluorescent snakes. I remember the smell, like the monkey house in a big zoo, but even worse. And then, nothing.
Do any of you remember what it really was?
No, Eddie said.
I think, Richie began, and then Bill could almost feel him shake his head in the dark.
No.
No, Beverly said.
Uh-uh, that was Ben.
That's the one thing I still can't remember. What it was, or how we fought it.
Chud, Beverly said.
That's how we fought it. But I don't remember what that means.
Stand by, Mimi, Bill said. And I'll just hand by you guys.
Bill, Ben said. His voice was very calm. Something is coming. Bill listened. He heard dragging, shambling footsteps approaching them in the dark. And he was afraid.
Audra, he called,
and knew already that it was not her. Whatever was shambling toward them drew closer. Bill struck a light. 8. Derry, 5 a.m. The first wrong thing happened on that late spring day in 1985, 2 minutes before official sunrise. To understand how wrong it was, one would have to have known 2 facts that were known to Mike Hanlon, who lay unconscious in the Derry Home Hospital as the sun came up, both concerning the Grace Baptist Church, which had stood on the corner of Wycham and Jackson since 1897. The church was topped with a slender white spire, which was the apotheosis of every Protestant church steeple in New England. There were clock faces on all 4 sides of the steeple base, and the clock itself had been constructed and shipped from Switzerland in the year 1898. The only one like it stood in the town square of Haven Village, 40 miles away. Stephen Bowie, a timber baron who lived on West Broadway, donated the clock to the town at a cost of some $17,000. Bowie could afford it. He was a devout churchgoer and deacon for 40 years. During several of those later years, he was also president of Derry's Legion of White Decency chapter. In addition, he was known for his devout layman sermons on Mother's Day, which he always referred to reverently as Mother's Sunday. From the time of its installation until May 31, 1985, that clock had faithfully chimed every hour and each half. With one notable exception. On the day of the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks, it had not chimed the noon hour. Residents believed that the Reverend Jollin had silenced the clock to show that the church was in mourning for the dead children, and Jollin never disabused them of this notion, although it was not true. The clock had simply not chimed.
nor did it chime the hour of 5 on the morning of May 31st, 1985. At that moment, Oliver Derry, old-timers opened their eyes and sat up, disturbed for no reason they could put their fingers on. Medicines were gulped, false teeth put in, pipes and cigars lit. The old folks stood a watch. One of them was Norbert Keene, now in his 90s. He hobbled to the window and looked out at a darkening sky. The weather report the night before had called for clear skies, but his bones told him it was going to rain, and hard. He felt scared, deep inside him. In some obscure way, he felt threatened, as if a poison were working its way relentlessly toward his heart. He thought randomly of the day the Bradley gang had ridden heedlessly into Derry, into the sights of 75 pistols and rifles. That kind of work left a man feeling kind of warm and lazy inside, like everything was somehow confirmed. He couldn't put it any better than that, even to himself. Work like that left a man feeling like he maybe might live forever. And Norbert Keene damn near had. 96 years old come June 24th, and he still walked 3 miles every day. But now he felt scared. "Those kids," he said, looking out his window, unaware he had spoken. "What is it with them damn kids? What they monkeying around with this time?" Egbert Thorogood, 99, who had been in the Silver Dollar when Claude Heroux turned up his axe and played the Dead March for 4 men on it, awoke at the same moment, sat up, and let out a rusty scream that no one heard. He had dreamed of Claude, only Claude had been coming after him, and the axe had come down, and a moment after it did, Thorogood had seen his own severed hand twitching and curling on the counter. "Something wrong," he thought in his muddy way, frightened and shaking all over in his pea-stained long johns. "Something dreadful wrong." Dave Gardner, who had discovered George Denbrough's mutilated body in October of 1957, and whose son had discovered the first victim of this new cycle earlier in the spring, opened his eyes on the stroke of 5 and thought, even before looking at the clock on the bureau, "Grace Church clock didn't chime the hour. What's wrong?" He felt a large, ill-defined fright. Dave had prospered over the years. In 1965, he had purchased the Shoeboat, and now there was a second Shoeboat at the Derry Mall and a third up in Bangor. Suddenly, all of those things he had spent his life working for, seemed in jeopardy. "From what?" he cried to himself, looking at his sleeping wife. "From what? Why are you so goddamn antsy just because that clock didn't chime?" But there was no answer. He got up and went to the window, hitching at the waistband of his pajamas. The sky was restless with clouds racing in from the west, and Dave's disquiet grew. For the first time in a very long while, he found himself thinking of the screams that had brought him to his porch 27 years ago to see that writhing figure in the yellow rain slicker. He looked at the approaching clouds and thought, "We're in danger. All of us. Derry." Chief Andrew Rademacher, who really believed he had tried his best to solve the new string of child murders that had plagued Derry, stood on the porch of his house, thumbs in his Sam Brown belt, looking up at the clouds, and felt the same disquiet. "Something getting ready to happen. Looks like it's going to pour buckets, for one thing. But that's not all." He shuddered, and as he stood there on his porch, the smell of the bacon his wife was cooking wafting out through the screen door, the first dime-sized drops of rain darkened the sidewalk in front of his pleasant Reynolds Street home, and somewhere just over the horizon from Basie Park, thunder rumbled. Rademacher shivered again. 9. George, 5:01 a.m. Bill held the match up and uttered a long, trembling, despairing screech. It was George wavering up the tunnel toward him, George, still dressed in his blood-spattered yellow rain slicker. One sleeve dangled limp and useless. George's face was white as cheese, and his eyes were shiny silver. They fixed on Bill's own.
"My boat," Georgie's lost voice rose, wavering in the tunnel. "I can't find it, Bill. I've looked everywhere, and I can't find it, and now I'm dead, and it's your fault, your fault, your fault."
"Georgie," Bill shrieked. He felt his mind tottering, ripping free of its moorings. George stumbled, staggered toward him, and now his one remaining arm rose toward Bill.
the white hand at the end of it hooked into a claw. The nails were dirty and grasping.
Your fault,
George whispered and grinned. His teeth were fangs. They opened and closed slowly, like the teeth in a bear trap.
You sent me out, and it's all your fault.
No, Georgie, Bill cried.
I didn't.
No.
Kill you,
George cried, and a mixture of dog-like sounds came out of that fanged mouth. Yips, yelps, howls, a kind of laughter. Bill could smell him now, could smell George rotting. It was a cellar smell, squirmy, the smell of some final monster standing slumped and yellow-eyed in the corner, waiting to unzip some small boy's guts. George's teeth gnashed together. The sound was like billiard balls clicking off one another. Yellow pus began to leak from his eyes and dribble down his face. And the match went out. Bill felt his friends disappear. They were running, of course they were. They were leaving him alone. They were cutting him off, as his parents had cut him off, because George was right. It was all his fault. Soon he would feel that single hand seize his throat. Soon he would feel those fangs pulling him open. And that would be right. That would be only just. He had sent George out to die, and he had spent his whole adult life writing about the horror of that betrayal. Oh, he had put many faces on it, almost as many faces as it had put on for their benefit. But the monster at the bottom of everything was only George, running out into the receding flood with his paraffin-coated paper boat. Now would come the atonement.
You deserve to die for killing me,
George whispered. He was very close now. Bill closed his eyes. Then yellow light splashed the tunnel, and he opened them. Richie was holding up a match.
Fight it, Bill,
Richie shouted. God's sake, fight it.
What are you doing here?
He looked at them, bewildered. They hadn't run after all. How could that be? How could that be after they had seen how foully he had murdered his own brother?
Fight it,
Beverly was screaming. Oh, Bill, fight it. Only you can do this one. Please. George was less than 5 feet away now. He suddenly stuck his tongue out at Bill. It was crawling with white fungoid growths. Bill screamed again.
Kill it, Bill, Eddie shouted. That's not your brother. Kill it while it's small. Kill it now.
George glanced at Eddie, cutting his shiny silver eyes that way for just a moment, and Eddie reeled back and struck the wall as if he had been pushed. Bill stood mesmerized, watching his brother come toward him. George again, after all these years. It was George at the end, as it had been George at the beginning. Oh, yes, and he could hear the creak of George's yellow slicker as George closed the distance. He could hear the jingle of the buckles on his overshoes, and he could smell something like wet leaves, as if underneath the slicker George's body was made of them, as if the feet inside George's galoshes were leaf feet. Yes, a leaf man, that was it, that was George. He was a rotted balloon face and a body made of dead leaves, the kind that sometimes choked the sewers after a flood. Dimly he heard Beverly shriek.
He thrusts his fists.
Bill, please, Bill.
Against the posts and still insists. We'll look for my boat together,
George said. Thick yellow pus, mock tears rolled down his cheeks. He reached for Bill, and his head cocked sideward, his teeth peeling back from those fangs.
He sees the ghosts, he sees the ghosts, he sees... We'll find it,
George said, and Bill could smell its breath, and it was a smell like exploded animals lying on the highway at midnight. As George's mouth yawned, he could see things squirming around inside there.
It's still down here. Everything floats down here. We'll float, Bill. We'll all float.
George's fish-belly hand closed on Bill's neck.
He sees the ghosts. We see the ghosts. You see the ghosts.
George's contorted face drifted toward Bill's neck.
Float. He thrusts his fists against the posts, Bill cried.
His voice was deeper, hardly his own at all. And in a searing flash of memory, Richie remembered that Bill only stuttered in his own voice. When he pretended to be someone else, he never did. The George thing recoiled, hissing, its hand going to its face in a warding-off gesture.
That's it, Richie screamed deliriously. You got it, Bill. Get it, get it, get it.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts, Bill thundered. He advanced on the George thing.
You're no ghost. George knows I didn't mean for him to die. My folks were wrong. They took it out on me, and that was wrong. Do you hear me? The George thing abruptly turned, squealing like a rat. It began to run and ripple under the yellow slicker. The slicker itself seemed to be dripping, running in bright blots of yellow. It was losing its shape, becoming amorphous. "He thrusts his fists against the posts, you son of a bitch," Bill Denbro screamed, "and still insists he sees the ghosts." He leaped at it, and his fingers snagged in the yellow rain slicker that was no longer a rain slicker. What he grabbed felt like some strange warm taffy that melted under his fingers as soon as he had closed his fist around it. He fell to his knees. Then Richie yelled as the guttering match burned his fingers and they were plunged into darkness again. Bill felt something begin to grow in his chest, something hot and choking and as painful as fiery nettles. He gripped his knees and drew them up to his chin, hoping it would stop the pain or perhaps ease it. He was dimly thankful for the dark, glad that the others couldn't see this agony. He heard a sound escape him, a wavering moan. There was a second, a third. "George," he cried. "George, I'm sorry. I never meant for anything bad to happen." Perhaps there was something else to say, but he could not say it. He was sobbing then, lying on his back with one arm over his eyes, remembering the boat, remembering the steady beat of the rain against his bedroom windows, remembering the medicines and the tissues on the night table, the faint ache of fever in his head and in his body. Remembering George, most of all that. Remembering George. George in his yellow hooded slicker. "George, I'm sorry," he cried through his tears. I'm sorry, please, I'm so sorry." And then they were around him, his friends, and no one lit a match, and someone held him. He didn't know who, Beverly maybe, or maybe Ben or Richie. They were with him, and for that little while the darkness was kind. 10. Derry, 5:30 a.m. By 5:30 it was raining hard. The weather forecasters on the Bangor radio stations expressed mild surprise and tendered mild apologies to all the people who had made plans for picnics and outings on the basis of yesterday's forecasts. Tough break, folks. Just one of those odd weather patterns that sometimes developed in the Penobscot Valley with startling suddenness. On WZON, meteorologist Jim Witt described what he called an extraordinarily disciplined low-pressure system. That was putting it mildly. Conditions went from cloudy in Bangor to showery in Hampton to drizzly in Haven to moderate rain in Newport. But in Derry, only 30 miles from downtown Bangor, it was pouring. Travelers on Route 7 found themselves moving through water that was 8 inches deep in places, and beyond the Ruland Farms, a plugged culvert and a dip had covered the highway with so much water that the highway was actually impassable. By 6 that morning, the Derry Highway Patrol had orange detour signs on both sides of the dip. Those who waited under the shelter on Main Street for the first bus of the day to take them to work stood looking over the railing at the canal, where the water was ominously high in its concrete channel. There would be no flood, of course. All agreed on that. The water was still 4 feet below the high water mark of 1977, and there had been no flood that year. But the rain came down with steady pounding persistence, and thunder grumbled in the low clouds. Water ran down Up Mile Hill in streams and roared in the storm drains and sewers. No flood, they agreed, but there was a patina of unease on every face. At 5:45, a power transformer on a pole beside the abandoned Tracker Brothers truck depot exploded in a flash of purple light, spraying twisted chunks of metal onto the shingled roof. One of the flying chunks of metal severed a high-tension wire, which also fell on the roof, spluttering and twisting like a snake, shooting an almost liquid stream of sparks. The roof caught fire in spite of the downpour, and soon the depot was blazing. The power cable tumbled from the roof to the weedy verge that led around to the lot where small boys had once played baseball. The Derry Fire Department rolled for the first time that day at 6:02 a.m. and arrived at Tracker Brothers at 6:09. One of the first firemen off the truck was Kelvin Clark, one of the Clark twins with whom Ben, Beverly, Richie, and Bill had gone to school. His third step away from the truck brought the sole of his leather boot down on the live line. Kelvin was electrocuted almost instantly. His tongue popped out of his mouth and his rubber fireman's coat began to smolder. He smelled like burning tires at the town dump. At 6:05 a.m., residents of Merritt Street in the Old Cape felt something that might have been an underground explosion. Plates fell from shelves and pictures from walls.
At 6:06, every toilet on Merritt Street suddenly exploded in a geyser of shit and raw sewage as some unimaginable reversal took place in the pipes which fed the holding tanks of the new waste treatment plant in the Barrens. In some cases, these explosions were strong enough to tear holes in bathroom ceilings. A woman named Ann Stewart was killed when an ancient gear wheel catapulted from her toilet along with a gout of sewage. The gear wheel went through the frosted glass of the shower door and passed through her throat like a terrible bullet as she washed her hair. She was nearly decapitated. The gear wheel was a relic of the Kitchener Ironworks and had found its way into the sewers almost 3/4 of a century before. Another woman was killed when the sudden violent reversal of sewage, driven by expanding methane gases, caused her toilet to explode like a bomb. The unfortunate woman, who was sitting on the John at the time and reading the current Banana Republic catalog, was torn to pieces. At 6:19 a.m., a bolt of lightning struck the so-called Kissing Bridge, which spanned the canal between Basie Park and Derry High School. The splintered pieces were thrown high into the air and then rained down into the swiftly moving canal to be carried away. The wind was rising. At 6:30 a.m., the gauge in the lobby of the courthouse building registered it at just over 15 miles an hour. By 6:45, it had risen to 24 miles an hour. At 6:46 a.m., Mike Hanlon awoke in his room at the Derry Home Hospital. His return to consciousness was a kind of slow dissolve. For a long time, he thought he was dreaming. If so, it was an odd sort of dream. An anxiety dream, his old psych prof Doc Abelson might have called it. There seemed to be no overt reason for the anxiety, but it was there all the same. The plain white room seemed to shriek menace. He gradually realized that he was awake. The plain white room was a hospital room. Bottles hung over his head, one full of clear liquid, the other a deep, dark red one, whole blood. He saw a blank TV set bolted to the wall and became aware of the steady sound of rain beating against the window. Mike tried to move his legs. One moved freely, but the other, his right leg, wouldn't move at all. The feeling in that leg was very faint, and he realized it was tightly bandaged. Little by little, it came back. He had settled down to write in his notebook, and Henry Bowers had turned up. A real blast from the past, a golden gasser. There had been a fight, and... Henry. Where had Henry gone? After the others? Mike groped for the call bell. It was draped over the head of the bed, and he had it in his hands when the door opened. A nurse stood there. Two buttons of his white tunic were unbuttoned and his dark hair was mussed, giving him a rumpled Ben Casey look. He wore a St. Christopher medal around his neck. Even in his soupy, only 3/4 awake state, Mike placed him immediately. In 1958, a 16-year-old girl named Cheryl LaMonica had been killed in Derry, killed by it. The girl had a 14-year-old brother named Mark, and this was him. Mark, he said weakly, I have to talk to you. Shh, Mark said. His hand was in his pocket. No talk. He walked into the room, and as he stood at the foot of the bed, Mike saw with a hopeless chill how blank Mark LaMonica's eyes were. His head was slightly cocked, as if hearing distant music. He took his hand out of his pocket. There was a syringe in it. This will put you to sleep, Mark said, and began to walk toward the bed. 11. Under the city, 6:49 a.m. Shh, Bill cried suddenly, although there had been no sound except their own faint footsteps. Richie struck a light. The walls of the tunnel had moved away, and the five of them seemed very small in this space under the city. They huddled together, and Beverly felt a dreamy sense of déjà vu as she observed the gigantic flagstones on the floor and the hanging nets of cobweb. They were close now. Close. What do you hear? She asked Bill, trying to look everywhere as the match in Richie's hand burned down, expecting to see some new surprise come lurching or flying out of the darkness. Rodan, anyone? The alien from that gruesome movie with Sigourney Weaver? A great scuttering rat with orange eyes and silver teeth? But there was nothing, only the dusty smell of the dark, and, far away, the thunder of running water, as if the drains were filling up. Something wrong, Bill said. Mike. Mike? Eddie asked. What about Mike? I felt it too, Ben said. Is it... Bill, did he die? No, Bill said. His eyes were hazy and distant, unemotional. All of his alarm was in his tone and the defensive posture of his body. He swallowed. There was a click in his throat. His eyes widened.
Oh. Oh, no.
Bill, Beverly cried, alarmed.
Bill, what is it? What?
Grab my hands, Bill screamed. Quick. Richie dropped the match and seized one of Bill's hands. Beverly grabbed the other. She groped with her free hand, and Eddie grasped it feebly with the hand at the end of his broken arm. Ben grasped his other hand and completed the circle by holding Richie's hand.
Send him our power, Bill cried in that same strange, deep voice. Send him our power, whatever you are. Send him our power, now.
Beverly felt something go out from them and toward Mike. Her head rolled on her shoulders in a kind of ecstasy, and the harsh whistle of Eddie's breathing merged with the headlong thunder of water in the drains.
12.
Now,
Mark LaMonica said in a low voice. He sighed, the sigh of a man who feels orgasm approaching. Mike pushed the call button in his hands again and again. He could hear it ringing at the nurse's station down the hall, but no one came. With a kind of hellish second sight, he understood that the nurses were sitting around down there, reading the morning paper, drinking coffee, hearing his call bell, but not hearing it. Hearing, but not responding. They would respond only later, when it was all over, because that was how things worked in Derry. In Derry, some things were better not seen or heard, until they were over. Mike let the call button fall from his hands. Mark bent toward him, the tip of the syringe glittering. His St. Christopher medal swung hypnotically back and forth as he drew the sheet down.
Right there, he whispered, the sternum,
and sighed again. Mike suddenly felt power wash into him, some primitive power that crammed his body like volts. He stiffened, fingers splaying out as if in a convulsion. His eyes widened, a grunt jerked out of him, and that sense of dreadful paralysis was driven from him as if by a roundhouse slap. His right hand pistoned out toward the night table. There was a plastic pitcher there and a heavy cafeteria-style water glass beside it. His hand closed around the glass. LaMonica sensed the change. That dreamy, pleased light disappeared from his eyes and was replaced by wary confusion. He drew back a bit, and then Mike brought the glass up and smashed it into his face. LaMonica screamed and staggered backward, dropping the syringe. His hands went to his spouting face. Blood ran down his wrists and splashed on his white tunic. The power left as suddenly as it had come. Mike looked dully at the shards of broken glass on the bed, and his hospital Johnny and his own bleeding hand. He heard the quick light sound of crepe-sole shoes in the hall approaching.
Now they come, he thought. Oh, yes, now. And after they're gone, who'll show up? Who'll show up next?
As they burst into his room, the nurses who had sat calmly on station as his call bell rang frantically, Mike closed his eyes and prayed for it to be over. He prayed his friends were somewhere under the city. He prayed they were all right. He prayed they would end it. He didn't know exactly who he prayed to, but he prayed nonetheless. 13. Under the city, 6:54 a.m.
He's all right, Bill said presently.
Ben didn't know how long they had stood in the darkness, holding hands. It seemed to him that he had felt something from them, from their circle, go out and then come back. But he did not know where that thing, if it existed at all, had gone or done.
Are you sure, Big Bill? Richie asked.
Yes.
Bill released Richie's hand and Beverly's.
But we have to finish this quick as we can. Come on.
They went on, Richie or Bill periodically lighting matches.
We don't have so much as a pea shooter among us, Ben thought. But that's part of it too, isn't it? Chud. What does that mean? What was it exactly? What was its final face? And even if we didn't kill it, we hurt it. How did we do that?
The chamber they walked through, it could no longer be called a tunnel, grew larger and larger. Their footfalls echoed. Ben remembered the smell, that thick zoo smell. He became aware that the matches were no longer necessary. There was light now, light of a sort, a ghastly effulgence that was growing steadily stronger. In that marshy light, his friends all looked like walking corpses.
Wall up ahead, Bill,
Eddie said.
I didn't know.
Ben felt his heart begin to pick up speed. There was a sour taste in his mouth, and his head had begun to ache. He felt slow and frightened. He felt fat.
The door,
Beverly whispered. Yes, here it was. Once, 27 years before, they had been able to pass through that door by doing no more than ducking their heads. Now they would have to duck walk their way through or crawl on hands and knees. They had grown. Here was final proof, if final proof were needed. The pulse points in Ben's neck and wrists felt hot and bloody. His heart had picked up a light and rapid flutter that was close to arrhythmia. Pigeon pulse, he thought randomly and licked his lips. Bright greenish-yellow light flooded out from under the door. It shot through the ornate keyhole in a twisting shaft that looked almost thick enough to cut. The mark was on the door, and again they all saw something different in that strange device. Beverly saw Tom's face. Bill saw Audra's severed head with blank eyes that stared at him in dreadful accusation. Eddie saw a grinning skull poised over two crossed bones, the symbol for poison. Richie saw the bearded face of a degenerate Paul Bunyan, eyes narrowed to killer's slits. And Ben saw Henry Bowers. Bill, are we strong enough? He asked. Can we do this?
I don't know,
Bill said. What if it's locked? Beverly asked in a small voice. Tom's face mocked her.
It's not, Bill said. Places like this are never locked.
He placed the tented fingers of his right hand on the door. He had to bend over to do it, and pushed. It swung open on a flood of sick yellow-green light. That zoo smell wafted out at them, the smell of the past become the present, horribly alive, obscenely vital.
Roll, wheel,
Bill thought randomly and looked around at them. Then he dropped to his hands and knees. Beverly followed, then Richie, then Eddie. Ben came last, his flesh crawling at the feel of the ancient grit on the floor. He passed through the portal, and as he straightened up in the weird glow of fire crawling up and down the dripping stone walls in snakes of light, the last memory socked home with the force of a psychic battering ram. He cried out, staggering back, one hand going to his head, and his first incoherent thought was, "No wonder Stan committed suicide. Oh, God, I wish I had." He saw the same expressions of stunned horror and dawning realization on the faces of the others as the last key turned in the last lock. Then Beverly was shrieking, clinging to Bill, as it raced down the gossamer curtain of its webbing, a nightmare spider from beyond time and space, a spider from beyond the fevered imaginings of whatever inmates may live in the deepest depths of hell.
No,
Bill thought coldly. Not a spider either. Not really, but this shape isn't one it picked out of our minds. It's just the closest our minds can come to the deadlights. Whatever it really is. End of side 27. To continue, turn the cassette over.